Good morning. I hope you are doing well. We're going to start our section on gases, which is actually a section of several chapters where we're going to look more at the properties of matter. And in Chem 221, one of the first days in lecture, if you had me for Chem 221, I brought some people down and we talked about the kinetic molecular theory, and I made some people like walk forward and walk backwards. And anyway, they were solids and then they were liquids when they danced around. And finally, they turned into gases, and we're going to explore more now in these next couple chapters what these things actually mean. So it's kind of cool. If you took the midterm yesterday, awesome. I should be able to return it to you on Friday still. And if you have a class today or tomorrow, no one in here is like crying, at least not publicly in front of me. So it should be going okay and stuff like that. So we'll do that this week in lab today or tomorrow if you have lab on one of those days. But again, if all goes well, I should be able to return them on Friday. Any questions on that? Sweet. My sister was in a really bad wreck a couple years ago, and she feels, and it sounds like it, that the airbag literally saved her life. So it's kind of an important thing in society, and without the understanding of gases, we wouldn't have a very good way to implement an airbag. So when you have an accident, or intentionally or unintentionally, the airbag usually fills with nitrogen gas. Nitrogen's pretty inert, it's pretty cheap and stuff like that. This is the reaction that happens. It takes a compound called sodium azide, which is disturbed. You end up making then a lot of nitrogen gas. So for every 2 moles of solid you put in, you get 3 moles of nitrogen out.
In a collision involving a car equipped with airbags, the impact initiates a chemical reaction. Automobile airbags work when a sample of sodium azide detonates, producing nitrogen gas. This gas fills the bag. Using our understanding of the gas laws, we can calculate the quantity of sodium azide required to produce the appropriate amount of nitrogen gas.
When you have an airbag, you want to have it inflated just right. Like, you don't want to have it so much that it, bam, like, bangs into you and hurts you in that level. But you don't want to have it so underinflated that your head still goes ahead and hits the dashboard. So knowing the right amount of gas is really important, and that's what we'll start looking at now in this chapter.
According to the kinetic molecular theory, the molecules of a solid are locked in place, though they have motion. Molecules of a liquid are closely associated with each other, but move relative to one another. Molecules of a gas move independently and occupy a much larger volume than those of a corresponding liquid or solid.
So this picture right here, which was apparently taken in the Olympic area down by Olympia and stuff, is kind of neat for this because it shows arguably the different states of water and how it can exist. And of all the substances around us, this is probably the most common. So up in the Olympics themselves, on the highest points, there's usually snow that sticks around for a long time. That's solid water. And of course, we know that it can be ice and different things like that, but that's one form. And then, of course, here is the liquid water that the sailboat is on, which is another phase. And pushing this sailboat is air. Now, air is actually a combination of nitrogen and oxygen and stuff, but there's usually a pretty good amount of water. And especially over a body of water, you would expect there to be lots of water. So this shows that water, like all substances, at least in theory, can be available to us in more than one form. And water is definitely the best example. So water is H2O. And when you drink it and stuff, like Daria's got right there or something, H2O, all right? 2 hydrogens for 1 oxygen, you're good to go. However, if it's a warm day and Daria says, I could sure use my water to be a little colder and stuff, she can put an ice cube in, right? That's just solid water, H2O as well. You're not changing the bonds. You're not making it H3O or something like that, or OH and stuff. It's still water, but the differentiation between those two is how the water molecules talk to each other. And finally, it's late at night, and Daria is studying chemistry and stuff, and she goes, oh man, I can show you a little bit of tea, something to keep me going. All right, so she boils some water and stuff. She'll see the steam come up. That's also water, gaseous water. All right, shows the tea is ready to be used or whatever. All right, all of those are H2O. You're not changing H2O in any way, but what you are changing is how the water molecules orient themselves to each other. So we're going to talk about all of these phases. We're going to start with gases right here because chemists are filled with hot air. I mean, because gases are actually where thank you, Angelina, for laughing. Anyway, gases are historically where scientists really discovered a lot of these properties. And it's interesting because gases are arguably the hardest to study, all right? If I said, hey, Eleanor, I look at my gas and I open my hand, woo, the gas is gone, right? So it's interesting to me that in the 1700s and 1800s, these people did a lot of cool research on gases considering they're kind of difficult. After we do gases in this chapter, we'll jump over to solids first and then liquids. And solids are pretty well understood, but liquids we'll see are kind of crazy. And also, even though it's not on this little diagram, solutions are a big part of chemistry too. So we'll talk about those coming up. Okay, so when you think about a gas, all right, there's interesting properties that we should think about and see if we can consider things to make a model for what a gas is. First of all, is that between you and me right now, there's a gas, all right? And, you know, we're all able to breathe and stuff. So there's a lot of free space between the gas. Like, you can see me, and I can see you, at least most of you anyway. So there's a lot of free space that allows the light to go through, all right? Like, if I tried to get down here under the desk, all right, I can't see anybody. Well, maybe these guys on the left-hand side, but that's about it, right? The solid has less free space in it. And if I look through Daphne's water, I can kind of see you, but not as well. So gases, there's a lot of free space that allows you to see through the gas to see other things around, which is normal. You can also expand gases as much as you want. So I've got my gas here, I say, hey, Eleanor, look at my gas. I open it up, oh man, the gas has expanded, but it's expanded to this room, all right? Vadim just came in the door, he leaves the door open. Woo, some of my gas is gonna go outside and it'll probably go to the earth, all right, which is the next thing. But let's say the gravity was turned off for a little bit. Woo, it could in theory go to the universe, all right? There's nothing stopping the expansion of gases in theory, all right? Gravity and things like that do play a factor, obviously. But anyway, I'm smarter now, and I've got my gas in my hand. I'm like, oh, I gotta show this to Eleonora. So if I put my gas in a container, that's one way I could say, hey, look at my gas now. If you put gas in a container, the gas, after a little bit of time, takes up an equal concentration of gas all throughout the flask. So if you wait for just a little bit of time, my gas in a flask, let's say it's like Daria's water flask right there, there'd be just as much gas on the top as there is on the bottom. All right, it's evenly distributed. It takes sometimes a tiny bit of time to do that, but it's usually not too much time. Daria says, hey, Russell, look at my gas. And I'm like, oh, cool, but we open our gases at the same time. They go together, no problem. This is another property of gases called diffusion, all right? And diffusion is the mixing of gases. And it can be nitrogen and oxygen, or water and argon, or any of these kind of things. Usually gases mix pretty well together. Now we're gonna see that liquids and solids don't necessarily mix all the time together. But gases do, no problem. So in the early part of the 1800s and the late 1700s, people actually developed some models for the gases, which worked out pretty well. And they're using math, which is basically pretty simple kind of algebra. But what the model for gases depended on, one thing they found, it does depend on the volume of gas. So between my hand and this room, there's a volume difference, all right? We'll see that that's one of the things that affects how we can predict properties. Now, usually for gases, the volume that we're going to use, the unit we're going to use, is the liter. So we're kind of back to the world of liters and milliliters. Excuse me, how many milliliters in a liter? 1,000, good. We're going to be doing that a lot, so make sure you know that and stuff. Don't try to have to look it up and stuff. of 1,000 milliliters per liter. The temperature also plays a part, all right? It's a little nicer outside. It's not raining. I saw the moon this morning. There's a little bit of blue sky. Higher temperatures, usually more active. Lower temperatures, usually less active. Now, we're going to see that it's kind of important to have a Kelvin scale for the gases. But a lot of times we'll record things in Celsius, like we did in lab yesterday, or you will do today or tomorrow. How do you go from a Celsius temperature to a Kelvin temperature? Yes. Good. That's right. Good. You guys collectively came together. That was perfect. Yeah. You add something. I love it. And what you something is 273.15. So Celsius plus 273.15 gives you Kelvin. That's perfect. Yeah. So we'll do some of that kind of stuff in this chapter too. The amount of gas is important. If you have a fistful or you have a big cylinder full, it does make a difference. We'll use a lot of moles in this part. A lot of times the symbol for moles is N. So if you see a little N right there, it usually means moles. But the new kid on the block that I mentioned to you guys in lab yesterday, and we'll talk about in lab this week too, is pressure, all right? And the pressure of the gas is an important factor. Now, the default unit for pressure in this section is the atmosphere, which gets the symbol ATM. So if you see ATM, it's just a way to represent the pressure of the gas. So these things will come together and stuff in order to describe how gases behave. Now, even earlier than the 1700s and 1800s when gases came together, there were several people in Italy, including this guy named Torricelli, who were really practicing with gases. And Torricelli, 1643, I mean, that's just incredible. But anyway, he was basically using different substances, and he saw that as the days change, the amount of that they go up and down a column would change. So now formally, all right, what we can do for to make a barometer, which is like a thermometer, but for pressure, all right? So a temperature is measured with a thermometer, and a barometer is measured with pressure. Torricelli then, he created like a little vacuum in a tube. And what they usually use now is mercury, and we'll see why mercury is a little bit better for this kind of stuff than water, but you can use water too. Anyway, pressure then pushes up, and gravity pulls down. So it's kind of like an equilibrium. And as the pressure changes, then this column will go up and down, but you can actually measure this. It's a way to measure how much pressure you have. So anyway, if you have a thing of a mercury right here, which is 760 millimeters, so this is like getting out a ruler stick, all right, and 76 centimeters from the bottom to the top, they consider that a standard atmosphere, and that's where that ATM unit comes from. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. Oh, but first.
I had like a so-so date with Valerie. Now I'm number 9 on the speed dial.
So?
So, I used to be 7. I dropped 2 spots.
What, she's ranking you?
Yeah, the speed dial is like a relationship barometer.
What is a barometer exactly?
It's pronounced thermometer.
Okay, so my apologies for my panache for Seinfeld, but anyway, obviously barometer and thermometer are different, and you can at least be science ambassadors now. Thermometer for temperature, barometer for pressure. All right. So anyway, if you need to know, have a comparison unit for pressure, all right? The one that's used almost exclusively in chemistry is what's called, again, the atmosphere, and it's given the symbol ATM. All right, and an atmosphere is calibrated supposedly so that when you go to the ocean, Seaside, Newport, Lincoln City, whatever, and you stand literally at the water's edge, supposedly the pressure then is exactly 1 atmosphere. And that's not absolutely right, but that's what the idea is. So a standard atmosphere, which we'll talk about a lot in this class, is equal to 760 millimeters of mercury. And measuring pressures in millimeters of mercury is very, very common. So I would know slash memorize slash put in my calculators 760 millimeters equals an atmosphere. So if you need to have this conversion post-lab question number two, then you'll know like where it comes from. But just like everything, millimeters is a unit of length. And there are 10 millimeters in a centimeter. So once in a while, you'll see a unit of centimeters of mercury, no problem. 76 centimeters equals an atmosphere. This is considered an exact quantity too. So just like 60 seconds is exactly 1 minute, and we don't worry about sig figs, this number is the same thing. Exactly 760 millimeters of mercury equals an atmosphere. There are other types of units, though, that are important. A torr, which is named after Torricelli, who developed the barometer, is the same as a millimeter of mercury. So if you see that you have 760 torr, that also means you have 760 millimeters of mercury, which would be an atmosphere. However, if you had lab yesterday, or when you have lab today or tomorrow, currently in our group, we're using what's called a millibar. And I'll make jokes about chemists can't pass up a bar and stuff, but sorry. Remember, we are full of hot air. The jokes get worse. Anyway, 1,013 millibars is also equal to an atmosphere. And the millibar to atmosphere conversion will be important to you just because that's what we're using in lab right now. We have a little electronic barometer and stuff that measures things in millibars. So if you see a millibar and you need to turn it into atmosphere, just FYI. Now, in the old days, American units still dominated, so 29.9 inches of mercury is another way of thinking about it. A lot of times this is used on weather forecasts. If you watch, they'll say, oh, the barometer's rising to 28.7. Oh, it's inches, but that's the way it goes. Got to go with the flow. It's the same thing as one atmosphere. And if you wish to use a water-based barometer instead of mercury, you can. And there's some serious advantages of it. However, the major disadvantage is that you need something that's 34 feet tall. All right, so that would be way up here and probably into the library a little bit. So it's not very convenient. Like in 2507, 2506, our lab space, we don't have 30 feet of vertical space anywhere. So it's not convenient to have a water-based barometer. If you do have one, you can measure changes in pressure much more accurately because it goes up and down a lot faster than mercury, but it is kind of awkward. When I was at Dartmouth, we had one of these and it was in this like four-story building and stuff and you could see it. But anyway, I digress. Now, as well, the SI unit, which are kind of like the science, you know, people that lay the line down for units in science, the SI unit is called the Pascal, and sometimes, I think in physics this is what they use, 101.325 kilopascals is what's equal to an atmosphere. And also a millibar, which is what we use in our lab, is equal to a hectopascal, which is another crazy thing. So let me show you the ones that are going to be important for us. All right, millimeters of mercury to atmosphere. It's good to know that a torr and a millimeter of mercury, they're the same, and definitely know the millibar. But I'm throwing these other ones up here because you might see them in physics, you might see them on TV, et cetera, et cetera. Any questions?
We don't need to know Pascal.
No, it exists, and if you see a problem, especially in a physics class, then you'll know how to convert back to atmospheres if you need it. But atmospheres, we're going to see, is a big part of the gas laws and stuff, so that's why we use it so much. Okay. So nitrogen gas has a pressure of 452 millimeters of mercury. And let's say that you wanted to find what the pressure was in atmospheres, all right? You can totally do that. So again, how to convert from a millimeter of mercury to the atmosphere, the ATM, is you take this number and you divide by 760. Now remember that the 760 number is absolute, so we don't worry about significant figures for it. We have three sig figs going in. Our pressure should have three sig figs going out. So 452 divided by 760 gives you a number, and when you calculate what that number is, 0.595 atmospheres. We are definitely back in the world of math again. Your calculator will be your best friend in these next couple of chapters. And we're also back in the world then of significant figures. This is three sig figs. This is an absolute conversion, like 60 seconds per minute. So if you have three sig figs going in, you should get three sig figs going out. If you haven't seen sig figs for a while, or you just, you know, or shock treatment, you have blotted out of your memory, do not ever be afraid to come ask me questions on it. I'm happy to help. Any questions? At about sea level, you're supposed to have one atmosphere of pressure. That's the idea behind the atmosphere and why chemists have kind of got into it. However, as the elevation increases, usually then the pressure decreases, all right? Now, Gresham, Oregon, the city hall or whatever, which is where they measure these things, is supposedly 301 feet above sea level. So pressure is usually less than an atmosphere. But what was really interesting to me yesterday is that if you had lab, our pressure was actually larger than one atmosphere. It was larger than the 1,013 millibars. So it's not always less than one, but if you have to make a guess, say less than one. Usually the pressure is less than one atmosphere. Here's just some different things. Denver, the mile high city, is about 0.83 atmospheres usually. Bolivia, which is La Paz, which is much higher, 0.62. And if you go up to Mount Everest, where they're usually doing oxygen and stuff just to get to the top, 0.35 atmospheres. On the other hand, you go to Death Valley, places like that, which are below sea level even, then you sometimes have pressures which are larger than one atmosphere. So it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Okay. So Boyle. Look at these dates, man, 1600s. He was a person that, as well as wearing, you know, wigs that made Motley Crue jealous, he was really studying a lot of gases. And he studied the pressure and the volume properties of gases. And what he found is that pressure and volume, if you increase one of them, the other one decreases. And vice versa, you increase the second one, the first one decreases. So he came up with this idea that pressure times volume always is a constant. All right? This is called an inverse relationship because pressure times volume must always equal a constant. So you raise the pressure, your volume has to go down so that those two together equals K. But if you increase the volume, change the size of the capacity, then your pressure will go down. It's kind of interesting. We'll talk about the NRT. So if you think about this from a before and after kind of perspective, pressure times volume always has to equal a constant. So what you can do then is write this thing, P1 V1 equals P2 V2. So the pressure initially times the volume initially must equal the pressure at the end times the volume at the end. That would be one way to think about it. Or if you have some final pressures and volumes, you can back calculate what the initial values were, stuff like that.
Pressure and volume are inversely related. Weight on the plunger of a sealed syringe increases the pressure on the air in the syringe. The air cannot escape, but its volume reduces under the pressure.
So in this graph, sorry about that volume, the temperature thing there. If you plot volume and pressure, which is what the lower left-hand graph is, you don't get a linear relationship at all. And that just says that in this context, they're not related to each other. However, pressure and inverse volume, or volume and inverse pressure, when you plot it, you do see a nice straight line. And chemists love these kind of things and stuff because then you can make predictions as to what's going on. Now, in this context, what they're doing is they're putting lead on. The more lead is more pressure, and they're seeing the effect on the syringe. So more lead pushes the syringe down, so you have less pressure. If you take some lead off, the syringe will go back up, your volume increases. So you see this nice kind of relationship here, again, realizing that in this silly experiment, the pressure is proportional to the mass of the lead you add. Now, another player in the section, although a little bit later than Boyle, was a guy named Charles. All right, Charles was a balloonist, and he used to go around in big balloons and stuff in France and England and stuff and check it out. And at the time, these balloons would, like, leave City A, and they'd float over to City B, and in City B, they had no idea what the heck this was. So several of the balloons were attacked by the locals, you know, and stuff, and you had to run away. And I guess now they give the bottles of champagne when you land in the farmer's field to try and keep your balloon from being destroyed. But anyway, I digress again. Charles had studied volume of gases and temperature of gases, and he found that as the temperature of your gas increases, the volume increases, and as the temperature of the gas decreases, the volume decreases. So you can mathematically say that volume equals K times T, where K is a constant. So unlike pressure and volume, one would go up and the other one would go down, they're inverses. These guys are directly related to each other. As temperature goes up, the volume goes up, and vice versa. You can write this as V1 over T1 equals V2 over T2. Remember, V over T, if you put it in the denominator, has to equal a constant. So if initial set of conditions can be compared to a second set of conditions, that's what those kind of things stand for.
Temperature and volume are directly related. As heat is added to a sealed syringe, the volume of the air in the syringe increases. A plot of gas temperature and volume demonstrates that the relationship between them is linear. If we extrapolate the line down to a temperature of absolute zero, in principle, the gas has no volume.
Now, what we're seeing here is the effect of temperature on the volume. The syringe right there has a gas volume inside it. As you heat up the water around it, you're heating up the gas. The syringe begins to go up until it pops out, basically. The volume is getting larger as the temperature gets larger. And if you would cool that water down, the syringe, you would imagine, would shrink back down. The volume would go down as the temperature goes down. So this red line right here reflects some temperatures and volumes that are measured relatively easy around room temperature. However, a problem happens if you extrapolate, which means take the points and the places that you expect them to go. And scientists like to do this kind of stuff. It's what we do, I guess. But anyway, notice that if you go all the way back, past, this is like where we usually live up here, all the way down to zero Kelvin, you get to the point where the volume of the gas should equal zero. How likely is it? Do you think that matter, even if it's a gas, would have zero volume? Probably not real likely, all right? So what we're seeing here is that these laws do have some flaws to them, all right? If you could take a gas down to absolute zero, and there's problems with that in and of itself, but if you could, you would get down to the level of zero volume. And all matter has a density associated with it, mass over volume. There is no matter known that has a zero volume, which would be an infinite density or something like that. These things will run into troubles. And one of the trouble spots is really low temperatures. As your temperature gets lower and lower, some of these laws break down more and more. And we'll talk about that here. There is some fun stuff you can do with Charles' Law. This is a liquid nitrogen container, and what they're doing is they're placing balloons inside the liquid nitrogen, and what happens is this is super cold. So the volume goes down as the temperature goes down, so your balloons will literally shrink to nothing like that. If you let them wait at room temperature for a while, they do expand back pretty close to what they were before, which is kind of fun. So Charles' Law is kind of fun for those kind of things. Demonstration. So let's say that we have a volume of gas and it's 235 milliliters, and that's the volume at 25 degrees Celsius. And let's say we wanted to make that volume, we wanted to figure out what temperature we would need to make the volume increase to 310 milliliters, all right? And we're not changing the pressure and we're not changing the amount. So what we have here is V1, T1 equals V2, T2, all right? And at 235, which is the initial volume, we have a temperature of 25, and we want to see here what temperature, T2, it takes to get our volume to 310. So in theory, what we would do is we would multiply both sides by T2. So the T2s over here cancel. You then have T2 times 235 divided by 25 equals 310. And if you multiply both sides by quote unquote 25 over 235, these two cancel out. T2, 310 times 25 divided by 235. And you can plug it in. However, volume and temperature you saw in the last slide. I'm throwing in a temperature here of Celsius. What would happen to the temperature if I went down to the place where water froze? What temperature in Celsius does water freeze at? 32. No, I'm just giving you a bad time. Zero. Gabriel's absolutely right in Fahrenheit. Zero. I still loved it, you, so don't worry about it. I will give you a bad time about it, though. Zero Celsius is what I'm after. And the reason I bring that up is because if we had a zero Celsius temperature here, we could maybe multiply by zero, which would make the temperature zero at the end. Or even worse, if we had a temperature of zero in the denominator, mathematically you divide by zero and oh, the math world kind of freaks out on you and stuff, and your calculator says error and stuff like that. So you cannot use Celsius temperatures with these equations. It's possible you're going to divide by zero, which just sends mathematicians into a frenzy. It's also possible that you'll multiply by zero, which would make your result meaningless. So in this problem, I haven't done it because I wanted to show why this would be important. You must convert to Kelvin, all right? So before you multiply by 25 right there, add the 273. 273.15 is fine. This number stops at the 1, so it's okay to use 1. So what that means is this temperature you're going to get out initially is in Kelvin. So to get to an answer like one of these, then, you have to take the Kelvin and subtract 273 from it to get the actual answer. So the answer when all is said and done here is 120 degrees. 25 degrees Celsius, you've got to turn to Kelvin before you use it. Don't multiply or divide by Celsius on these. And again, the problem becomes because you could get to a place of zero. You can also get to negative Celsius values, which would make your temperatures negative and stuff. So Celsius is just not good for calculations. And that's why since Chem 221, I have made a big deal of talking about the Kelvin temperatures. For gases and stuff, they become really helpful. So anyway, in this problem, you end up with 393 Kelvin, and if you subtract 273 from it, you get 120 degrees Celsius. What does that little dot right there mean? It's a sig fig, that's right. Zero is often not a significant figure. So 120 without a dot would be a 2 sig fig number. However, in this value, you do have numbers that go out to the 1 spot. You want to include the 1 spot here as well. The dot helps you know that that's a 3 significant figure. Any questions on this problem? Okay. So, punchline of this section. All right. Anytime you're talking of gases, you must use Kelvin when it comes to calculations. All right. There's no exceptions to that. Got to use Kelvin all the time. And so often that means converting your initial value to Kelvin and then converting your answer from Kelvin back to Celsius.
So
we have
273,
that's right. If you, in this particular problem, the value was to the 1 spot. When you add and subtract, you want to go to, in this case, at least the 1 spot. So 25 plus 273.15 mathematically, it would be 298.15, but we can only count it to the one spot because that's where this answer went to. So when you take this answer of 393 and you subtract 273.15, make sure you cut it off at the one spot. Good. These are good questions. Other questions? Avogadro, when he did his work with Avogadro's number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, he was usually thinking about gases when he did it. So he had this idea that equal volumes of gases at the same temperature and pressure will have equal number of molecules. And so mathematically, what you can do is write volume as a function of moles n, volume and moles to have also this kind of constant thing. So let's say this balloon right here is a liter of volume, and we want to have a balloon at the same temperature and same pressure, but which is 2 liters. In theory, then, we'd have to add another mole, one mole plus one mole would make 2 moles. As the moles increase by 2, the volume would increase by 2. If we wanted to have a balloon go 4 times as big, we would have to have 4 moles instead of 1 mole, kind of thing. Sometimes this is expressed as V1 over N1 equals V2 over N2. So the moles will change, and the volume will be reflected as of that part. Now, you can also change the volume of things, but you won't change the amount of moles of gas, all right? Volume changes will result in temperature changes, maybe more likely a pressure change. It's in this context that the moles change, the volume will change along with it. There's some kind of cool things you can do from
quantity and volume are directly related. If we take 8 molecules of H2 and combine them with 4 molecules of O2, we get 12 molecules and a combined volume. If we then react the mixture, we end up with 8 molecules of gaseous H2O, which occupies the same volume as 8 molecules of any other gas.
Molecules are proportional to the moles. All right, you can take the molecules and divide by Avogadro to get the moles. And in this context, we're taking 8 molecules of H2 and 4 molecules of O2. Now, making water is a 2-to-1 ratio. 2 hydrogen molecules are needed for 1 oxygen molecule. So initially, when these two were combined, you had a bigger circle, and that tried to reflect the 12 molecules of gas you had before any reaction happened. But then there was a kind of a burst of energy. That's the reaction occurring. You end up with 8 molecules of water. The ratio of hydrogen to water is 2-to-2. So if you started with 8 here, you should end up with 8 there. But again, notice how now the oxygen is a smaller circle. The volume is smaller because there are fewer molecules, fewer moles. This is a little picture. It shows 3 balloons, all of the same volume. And this is kind of hard to see, but it's helium on the left, and this is ammonia on the middle, and oxygen on the right. I just noticed that should be a 17 right there. But anyway, it tries to show how this is 4 grams. This should be 17 grams. It says 15. Sorry about that. And oxygen, 32. The masses are different, but the number of molecules are the same. A mole of A mole of helium, there we go, is the same number of molecules as a mole of oxygen. That's why they're the same. They would feel different, all right? The oxygen has a lot more mass than the helium does, but the volume is the same. It's all about the number of moles in this context. So you can plot then the number of moles added versus the volume. At 1 mole, you've got this volume. At 2 moles, you'll have twice the volume. At 4 moles, you'll have 4 times the volume, stuff like that. Any questions? So this all leads to the most important law.
A bicycle pump forces air into the confined space of the tire. As more air is added to the tire, the pressure increases. The tire's volume increases slightly, and the air becomes warmer. These observations are predictable properties of gases, and, as we explore in this chapter, they are described by the gas laws.
Instead of spending your time memorizing like Boyle's law versus Charles' law versus Avogadro's law, etc., you can really derive all of those expressions from this thing, which is called the ideal gas law. And this is the real crux of all chemistry gas knowledge. If you want to pump your bicycle up, you have to first pressurize the pump. That's what you're kind of doing there. You're pushing it in, you're pressurizing it. And the volume of the tire will get bigger as the pressure begins to be pushed in there and stuff. However, along the way, the temperature of your gas will also increase. So you can figure out all these kind of things based on this expression. Now, most of these are pretty obvious. P is pressure, V is volume, N is moles, and T is the temperature. But there's an R in there as well, and R is something we'll spend a lot of time. Now, in the organic chemistry chapter, R was the alkyl group. We're not going to use that version of R, basically, from here on in now. Now we're going to start focusing on the more the math and science version of R, and it's called the gas constant. Now, the units of R will depend on, will make the number of R change. And we're going to use a couple of values of R here. 0.08206 is a 4 sig fig value of R that works really well for the gas law. This number comes from if you have a volume in liters, a pressure in atmospheres, moles, and Kelvin. Later on, we're going to use what I call the energy R. It's 8.31 or so. You can take liters of atmospheres, pressure, and volume, and turn them into joules, a type of energy, and you'll do that more in physics. But a joules mole Kelvin has a different value of R. They're all the same relationship, but we're changing the units on top of it. You could also take milliliters and turn them into liters if you want, and you would have a different value of R as well. So it's really important that you know R, and I'd like you to know the 5 sig fig value of it, but at least 4 would be good. So in the previous thing, it said R was 0.08206. That's 4 sig figs. This would be the 5 sig fig value, 0.082057. So you've got to know R. I wouldn't make a tattoo of it on your body, but I would memorize slash put in your calculator and stuff like that. All right. This is an example. We want to fill a room with nitrogen gas, and the room has 2.70 times 10 to the 4th liters. We want to fill it to a pressure of 745 millimeters of mercury, and it's going to be about room temperature, which is considered 25 degrees Celsius. We can figure out the quantity, which is basically moles, the moles of N2 required to do this if we use R. But because we're using R, we need to use volume in liters, which we have, but we need to convert our pressure to atmospheres, and as I said earlier, we always have to convert temperatures to Kelvin. So before you start these kind of problems, make sure you have all the right kind of units. The liters is already good, but we need to turn the temperature to Kelvin and the pressure to atmospheres. So 745 millimeters of mercury would be 0.980 atmospheres. 298 Kelvin comes from 25 degrees Celsius. Again, like Eleanor said earlier, notice that when you add and subtract, it's a little different sig fig kind of rules that multiply divide. We went from 2 sig figs here to a 3 sig fig temperature, and that's very common with these kind of problems. All right, once you have these values in the right units, then you can plug it into N equals PV over RT. So here's the pressure, 0.980. Here's the volume in liters. Here's the gas law R, 298 Kelvin. You end up with this number, 1.08 times 10 to the third moles. You can then go on and turn this into grams of N2 using the molar mass of N2. Remember to do that. Nitrogen is about 14 grams per mole, so N2 would be about 28 grams per mole. And it's a big number, so if you divide it by 1,000, that's where this 30.3 kilogram number is. Now again, we haven't done this stuff for a while, so as if you had nothing else to do between here on Friday, if you could make sure you can get these kind of numbers out of your calculator and stuff, that would be pretty cool, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Any questions on that? Cool. Hydrogen peroxide is sold in the stores in a brown bottle. You're supposed to keep it in the refrigerator. And the reason for that is it does decompose. It's a very active ingredient. It breaks down to water and oxygen. So let's say that we had 1.1 grams of hydrogen peroxide, and it's in a flask that has 2.50 liters of volume. We can actually use this information, if we know the temperature, to figure out the pressure of oxygen created and the pressure of the water. So in this context, both the water and the oxygen, we're going to assume, are turned into gases. A lot of times with hydrogen peroxide, the energy created is enough to turn the water into a gas right away. It's a pretty powerful reaction. This process is actually used by this little guy. He's like kind of a beetle, apparently. And when they spray things and stuff, a lot of times the pressure comes from the decomposition of hydrogen peroxide, which I find kind of interesting. Hydrogen peroxide is pretty cool. Anyway, so to solve this kind of problem, all right, we need to turn the grams of a liquid into moles of the liquid, and then we're going to turn moles of the liquid into moles of the gas. And you can do water or oxygen. But we're after the pressure of the gases, not just the moles. So once we have the moles, for example, of oxygen, we can turn that into a pressure of oxygen. And again, if you decide to do oxygen first and water second, that's cool. You can also do water first and oxygen second. It doesn't matter. So we need to find the moles right away of hydrogen peroxide. And we'll use stoichiometry, which is the 2-to-2 ratio, to convert from hydrogen peroxide to water, or we can go hydrogen peroxide to oxygen. That would be a 2-to-1 ratio if we do that to oxygen. And once we have the moles of oxygen or water, we can use PV equals NRT. We can solve for the pressure of the gas and stuff from there. Okay, so in this problem, take the grams of hydrogen peroxide and turn them into moles. 34 grams per mole is the molar mass of H2O2. And to get this number, each oxygen on the periodic table is about 16 grams per mole, and there's two of them. So 16 times 2 is 34. Hydrogen is about 1 gram per mole, and there's two of them. So 32 from the oxygen plus about 2 for hydrogen is where this number comes from. Any questions on where that number comes from? We haven't done a lot of molar mass yet this term. Okay, so that gets us the unexciting 0.032 moles of hydrogen peroxide number. And from moles, we can then use the balanced chemical reaction to turn moles of hydrogen peroxide into moles of water or moles of oxygen. And what I'm going to do in this example is I'm first going to turn it into moles of oxygen. So the balanced equation says 2 moles of hydrogen peroxide are needed to create 1 mole of oxygen. So I'll take the moles of hydrogen peroxide and essentially multiply by 1/2 to get the moles of oxygen. And there's no reason why you couldn't go to moles of water first. You would just have a 2-to-2 ratio instead of 1-to-2, same kind of thing. From this number, then, you can find the pressure of the oxygen. So PV equals NRT, and if you want to solve for the pressure, you would go NRT over V. So this is for the gas O2. I would put the moles of O2 in there. Here's the good old R constant again. 25 degrees Celsius is 298 Kelvin, and I'll divide by the volume of this flask right here. This comes out to be 0.16 atmospheres. That's the pressure of the oxygen when 1.1 grams of hydrogen peroxide is decomposed. Questions on that? Now, As you can see, this was a lot of fun converting. And to convert to the pressure of water, we would have to go back to the moles of hydrogen peroxide. 2 to 2 would give us moles of water. Put that number in there to find the new number right there. However, one trick that helps is that these pressures are proportional to the quantity. So if it took 0.16 atmospheres, we got 0.16 atmospheres out of oxygen, and there's a 2-to-1 ratio of water to oxygen, the pressure of the water should be twice as big as the pressure of the oxygen. So notice that there's 1 mole of oxygen created for every 2 moles of water. If the pressure of oxygen was 0.16, then 2 times that number will give you the pressure of the water. So instead of going through all those individual steps again, if you know the ratio, the stoichiometry of the water to the oxygen, you can just multiply that number by 2 and you can calculate what the pressure of the water is. This is an example of what's called Dalton's Law of Partial Pressures. The ratio of the gases created is dependent on the stoichiometry. So 1 oxygen to 2 waters, if this is 0.16, then water will be twice that big. Also, the total pressure will be just the sum of the individual pressures. This is good old Dalton right here. We talked about it in Chem 221. If we mix these 3 gases together with their individual kilopascal pressures, if you add those 3 together, that's what your total pressure is going to be. Gases mix really well, which is really interesting. All right, we'll do more of this on Friday. Have a wonderful day. I'll see you soon. Yeah.